Hello, my name is Haysan Sorrells, and this is the Leadership Lessons from the Great Books podcast, episode number 6, with my guest today, David Baumrucker. Why, hello, David.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good. The idea of eternal return is a mysterious one, and Nietzsche has often perplexed other philosophers with it. To think that everything recurs as we once experienced it, and that the reoccurrence itself recurs ad infinitum. What does this mad myth signify? Putting it negatively, the myth of eternal return states that a life which disappears once and for all, which does not return, is like a shadow, without weight, dead in advance, and whether it was horrible, beautiful, or sublime, its horror, sublimity, and beauty mean nothing. We need take no more note of it than of a war between two African kingdoms in the 14th century, a war that altered nothing in the destiny of the world, even if 100,000 blacks perished in excruciating torment. Will the war between two African kingdoms in the 14th century itself be altered if it recurs again and again in eternal return? It will. It will become a solid mass, permanently protuberant, its inanity irreparable. If the French Revolution were to recur eternally, French historians would be less proud of Robespierre. But because they deal with something that will not return, the bloody years of the Revolution have turned into mere words, theories, and discussions, having become lighter than feathers, frightening no one. There is an infinite difference between a Robespierre who occurs only once in history and a Robespierre who eternally returns, chopping off French heads. Totalitarian times, tyrannical times, nihilistic, existential, deconstructed times, postmodern times, all of these times fundamentally create weak people. Tyrannical times create weak men, and then weak men lead others weakly. Chinese writer, translator, linguist, and inventor Lin Yutang was correct when he wrote, "When small men begin to cast big shadows, it means that the sun is about to set." This epiphenomenon occurs not only as a result of weakness in the macro, at the apex of an organization or a culture, it's also at the micro, individual level of leadership. Leadership begins inside and moves inevitably and irrevocably, relationally to the outside with others. Which is why there's leadership everywhere you look, from dyadic coupling to multidimensional sprawling teaming. But when the system that one is under and another is under is tyrannical, then there can be no opportunity for truth. There can be no opportunity for justice. There can be no opportunity for anything other than the acidity of moral weakness. In our time, moral weakness is on display everywhere a human being with eyes to see, ears to hear, and a mind to discern can possibly look. So the question in this day, at this moment, for leaders in these tyrannical times is, if I am morally weak, how can I effectively lead others? And if others, if my followers are weaker than I am, or even worse, if they have the expectation or assumption of moral weakness, how can I lead them with moral strength? We're going to talk about Milan Kundera's famous book, part of the triad of the 20th century that goes along with 100 Years of Solitude, The Gulag Archipelago, and this third book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being Today, with my guest, David Baumrucker, who has more alphabet soup behind his name than I do. And yet we've both come to, I think, similar conclusions to our 20th century Nietzschean nightmare of moral weakness, individualized totalitarianism, and deeply personalized revolution. David has worked in the field of mental health for many years, and of course, when the COVID crisis struck, I absolutely hate the word pandemic, as you all know who are listening, David's business exploded. He'll talk more about his knowledge of these areas, but I wanted him to come on today and join us here on the podcast for a couple of reasons. One, he's one of the most unassuming people you'd ever meet, and you'll see that on the video. If you're listening to this on audio, you may hear it come through in his voice, but you'll definitely get to see it on the video, so I would encourage you to watch that. And just like myself, number two, he came out of the wilds of northern Minnesota. We actually share the same bachelor's degree in fine arts, playing rugby and learning many of the same hard lessons that I learned playing that sport as well. And when you're talking about the epiphenomenon of weakness in our technologically advanced yet more abundant time, and I do fundamentally believe this after reading Unbearable Lightness of Being, we have to talk about the mental and the physical in order to understand and apply the lessons of the philosophical and even the psychological that we are confronted with in this novel, which was published in Czech in 1984. And we have some interesting things to say, or I have some interesting things to say about Kundera, about moral weakness, and about the curse even of communism and totalitarianism, and why I do fundamentally believe that for leaders in our time, the struggle is how to overcome individualized totalitarianism and the small T totalitarians. They're looking to replicate a lot of what the big T totalitarians replicated, to the tune of 100 million dead. But don't worry, we've forgotten all that. It's almost as if, Kundera would say, it never really happened. Welcome, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, man. I appreciate the opportunity to come down and have this conversation with you. You know, there's a lot of different aspects of this book that, that transcend both our culture and the work I do every day. And so I'll be... It's going to be a fascinating conversation just as we work our way through this, maybe, and I can, with time permitting, I'll maybe provide some insights about how this affects us on a personal level as much as it does on a societal level.
Let's talk a little bit about that before we kind of jump into kind of a little bit more of the book. So that, tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about kind of how you're thinking about, not even necessarily the book, talk a little bit about your background. I'll start with that. So sure. How did you come to the work that you do, and why do you think it's important for leaders to go through this kind of work or be involved in this or engaged with this? And how do you, after looking over the book, how do you see those two things maybe sort of, or three things sort of intersecting?
Okay. Yeah. Great questions. My background, again, we started kind of in similar paths, northern Minnesota. And from that place, I did my degree in psychology as well as fine arts. And I started kind of dabbling in the mental health arena, doing everything from, you know, upward bound mentoring to high school outreach to, again, the rugby program and different things like that. When I moved out west to Missoula, Montana, and my fiance and I, we lived out there for just under 8 years. And in that time, I had the opportunity of landing a job working for a behaviorist, a team that's we're working with autistic adults that were severely emotionally disturbed adults. So there was a significant amount of clinical lens that we had to apply to certain things. But again, just how life has this kind of happenstance way, I found myself having some chance encounters with some people that led me to the path of doing my master's program. And so while I did that at the University of Montana in Missoula, Montana, I both did kind of an interesting thing. I dabbled in career counseling, held an office at the university for a while, held an office as a clinical counseling intern. After I graduated, I worked at the Western Montana Mental Health Center for about 2.5 years. And that's the equivalent in Minnesota would be like the Mayo Clinic, a multidisciplinary campus that has teams of professionals that work kind of interlaced with each other. One of my primary functions of that was not only working with homeless people and working with kind of the homeless outreach, but working with individuals that were, I guess, for lack of better terms, banking on entitlement. Banking on someone else to solve the problem. And it was an incredible insight to a part of this country and a part of our culture that doesn't really show up as much in the Midwest, at least for the lower income people. But that really influenced me, and I was able to get cross-trained by a tremendous amount of different professionals, which again kept on evolving who I was and who I was becoming. I made my way back to Minnesota in the summer of 2018, where I ended up essentially working at a joint private practice in Minneapolis for a while before I, decided to make the choice and step out into private practice with Brandon, my fiance. We've been doing that since September of 2019. And so we were fortunate enough to open our practice before, I guess the My Sharona Cyrus type of situation happened.
You could, it's okay. You can call it a pandemic. It's like other people use that word. It's fine. I personally have a problem with it for just a variety of reasons that are my own, but you wouldn't use it for what you use.
Well, you know, and, it, and I guess it's, you know, with that, you know, we, I was really shielded from quite a bit of it. And I guess I had, I count my blessings because of that. I know there's some, so many people were not, but being, at the helm of my own ship, I was able to navigate those waters that were presented in 2020 and in for the first, I guess, for the majority of 2021, where I didn't have to bend the knee as much. And I was able to kind of continue doing what I was doing, which going to what you, how you introduced me in the beginning, which led to kind of a cascading effect with my practice growing. I took a very just no nonsense approach, and we got down to brass tacks with helping people and working on their life. And you know, consequently, with what's going on with the world, we ended up talking about meaning, and we ended up talking about how do we make meaning and how do I live a life that I'm actually proud of? Because that became a very, very sharp knife. This started to cut through every single conversation I had with people, that next thing you know, people are living lives that they don't respect. People are doing things, people are having affairs, but that kind of tailors its way with the book. And then we find people very disconnected with the idea of themselves. We find people very disconnected with the idea of America. And it became a very, very interesting conversation where this rolling depression that showed up with everyone wasn't so much on, it was on a personal level, but the origins of what the focus of that depression was on such a macro level, such a discontinuity with the world that people found themselves in, that I found it to be it kind of staggering, at least when we got into the first part of 2021, and to see that it didn't actually alleviate itself, it actually compounded on itself. And I think that when we, more recently, when I've paid attention to these different things, and you were asking like where I was going and how this applies to the book, you know, my focus now is I'm pursuing opportunities potentially to get into doing different collaborations with other clinicians, and also possibly looking into the world of psychedelics and working into psychedelic research and doing those things. When it comes down to, I guess, how this applies to maybe the, what's presented in the book, I think, is that the question you asked me? What's the follow-up?
Yeah, you know, when we, so you mentioned infidelity, you mentioned betrayal. Yeah. These are aspects of the first part of the book that really lay out, I would say, in the first. And the book is divided up. Let me kind of talk about that a little bit for those of us who haven't read it, right? So the book is divided up into, I think it's five to six mini books. Let me go ahead and look at my physical copy, right? So yeah, it's divided up into, let's see. Yeah, seven. There we go. Seven, you know, mini books, right? And each one of these mini books focuses on an aspect of the relationship between these four characters, right? And we'll talk a little bit about that relationship in a little bit. So, you know, Tomas and Teresa, and then Sabina and Franz. And then there's a Marie Claire, and there's some other folks, you know, kind of thrown in there. There's even the dog, Karenin, named after Anna Karenina, you know, Tolstoy's second greatest novel. Anyway, in my humble opinion. But you know, it's divided up into these seven parts. And the thing the book really pinwheels around, at least the first, I would say maybe three books, really pinwheels around, that's kind of what I want to focus on today. And there's a lot of the book. Go buy it. If you're listening to this podcast right now, go buy it. It is part of the trilogy, considered to be the trilogy of the 20th century, that really critiqued communism for the West. And so this book, along with, like I said, The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which we'll be reading on a future podcast, and 100 Years of Solitude, which if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to that one, by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, really are considered to be the three books, at least I've read, are considered to be the three books that critiqued communism and sort of broke it down into its component parts. And The Gulag Archipelago is, of course, considered to be the book that brought down an empire. But at the core of Kundera's conception of communism is this idea of infidelity and betrayal, which ties into what you're saying about, and what I was saying in the opening there, about the epiphenomenon of this weakness and how that kind of cuts through from the individual all the way upward to the state. And I'm going to bring this up later on, but the East German Stasi, you know, at the height of communism, claimed that, you know, one out of every three people or something like that was an informer, which means if you looked around in your house and you had five people in your family, at least two of them were listening to you all the time. And they assumed that at least three of them were listening to them all the time. You can't build trust. Then everything fractures, right? And so for leaders, because this is a leadership podcast, not a political science one, but for leaders, I guess the question is, particularly in our time and with what you're seeing, how do leaders bind folks together, you know? Because that ability to go along with the crowd, and we're going to see this in the sections that we're going to read in the book, that ability to just sort of waft along with the crowd.
Sure, I mean,
it is a sign of weakness, right? I mean, like, it's a sign of, yeah, you know? And maybe not psychological weakness, maybe not a mental health issue, right? Maybe something at a deeper level. You mentioned psychedelics. Dare I say a spiritual weakness?
I think so. I think that it's kind of all consuming, and the fact that when we ask me about how do leaders bring this together and how do they unify people, I think fundamentally, you know, looking at this book, but also looking at what happens in different people's lives, and even a microcosm of what we see in our politics, we get fractured when people are unwilling to be wrong, and when we get fractured when people are unwilling to show their humanity. And by humanity, I mean, we all have moments of vulnerability. We all have moments of unsuredness. And I think when people move forward with this blatant haste, this blatant almost like arrogance, almost hubris that, well, I've read one book. I know what I'm doing. I'm a senator. I must do what I'm doing. I run this multifaceted team. I make the six figures. And so why aren't you paying me? I think, or why aren't you listening to me? I think that we have... I think we've made the grave mistake that thinking the mistaking position equals value, or position equals leadership. Because I think position itself is nothing more than that. You just hold a position within a superstructure. I think it's what you do within that position that actually is what a leader is, or how a leader is found, or maybe born, if you want to use this language. It requires when we're talking to people, that you meet people at their level, that you also stop becoming the keeper of sacred knowledge. And I think when leaders make this fundamental error of coming down and talking down or talking at people, opposed to talking with people, right? They don't join the conversation, but rather they interject themselves over and above the conversation. That does not bring people together. In fact, that breeds resentment. And much whether it's people, you know, leaders bringing people together, or, you know, mothers and fathers and families trying to bring their families together, the rules are the same. It's just one level higher. If you're talking about leaders, we're talking on a communal level. We're talking of potentially a systemic level. If we're talking about, you know, the people, that's the family level. That's where we get back into this idea of the spiritual covenant we need to talk about. That will come up, I'm sure, later in this conversation. But I think that, you know, how do people bring people together? I think we have to demonstrate what leadership is. And I think that leaders are essentially a walking billboard for essentially what they value. And if we make the error as a leader of kind of casting this whole old school way of thinking, do as I say, not as I do mentality, I don't see how that would ever bring people together. And interestingly enough, when you see the most successful leaders, when you see the people that are kind of the thought leaders, or the people that are the tip of the spear in this arena, what are they doing? They're being incredibly, incredibly transparent. They're being human, not transparent for the sake of just being, you know, reckless, but they're showing people how they think. They're showing people how they approach it. They're showing people why it's important that I have this communication with you. And more importantly, that I'm still able to be humbled. I'm still able to be taught something, and I'm still able to learn something. I think that these are the fundamental things. And if we weave this back into what I was reading out of this book, and maybe some of the criticisms of communism or totality with a capital T that we see in our world today, there is an absolute, not just a rejection of these things, but it's a denial that these things have any value in this place. And I think it comes out of weakness. I think it comes out of insecurity. And I think it also comes out of a fundamental lack of depth that exists in this way of thinking. And I think that if we think about the fundamental lack of depth that exists within, I think, socialism and communism, I think that's the same thing when you get these very authoritarian leaders, whether it be in business, whether it be in, you know, higher education, whether it's going to be within a corporate space. I mean, a corporate almost B2B or B2C mm-hmm. kind of level, it doesn't matter. I think when people, if they don't leave room for themselves to be imperfect or in progress, or at least in the world of therapy, we never say we're competent. We're always in the pursuit of competence. And I think that that's a genius way of making sure that it grounds ourselves to say, no matter how good you get, you're still trending in a direction. You still need to be continuing to sharpen the blade and make it sharper, because we can.
Interesting. You brought up family. Back to the book. We're going to start there. Because fundamentally, you know, in our consultancy, what we do and the ways which we begin to focus in on the leader is we bring leaders into a room. We kind of psychologically strip them naked and then build them back up. Right. And the first kind of way to do that is to really impress upon leaders that you learned leadership in the crib. You learned it from your family. Family is the first organization. And it's the core organization. And, well, Kundera critiques that a little bit here. So back to the book. If the Pharaoh's Daughter from Unbearable Lightness of Being, the Harper Perennial Classics edition from 1999. By the way, this book was published in 1984. Go out and get the Harper Perennial Classics edition. It's the easiest one to read. Don't get the one online. That's nonsense. Get the physical copy if you're going to go out and get this book. Quote, if the Pharaoh's daughter hadn't snatched the basket carrying little Moses from the waves, there would have been no Old Testament, no civilization as we now know it. How many ancient myths begin with the rescue of an abandoned child? If Polybus hadn't taken in young Oedipus, Sophocles wouldn't have written his most beautiful tragedy. Tomas did not realize at the time that metaphors are dangerous. Metaphors are not to be trifled with. A single metaphor can give birth to love. He lived a scant 2 years with his wife, and they had a son. At the divorce proceedings, the judge awarded the infant to its mother and ordered Tomas to pay a third of his salary for its support. He also granted him the right to visit the boy every week. But each time Tomas was supposed to see him, the boy's mother found an excuse to keep him away. He soon realized that bringing them expensive gifts would make things a good deal easier than he was expected to bribe the mother for the son's love. He saw a future of quixotic attempts to inculcate his views in the boy, views opposed in every way to the mother's. The very thought of it exhausted him. When one Sunday, the boy's mother again canceled a scheduled visit, Tomas decided, on the spur of the moment, never to see him again. Why should he feel more for the child, to whom he was bound by nothing but a single improvident night, than for any other? He would be scrupulous about paying support. He just didn't want anybody making him fight for his son in the name of paternal sentiments. Needless to say, he found no sympathizers. His own parents condemned him roundly. If Tomas refused to take an interest in his son, then they, Tomas's parents, would no longer take an interest in theirs. They made a great show of maintaining good relations with their daughter-in-law and trumpeted their exemplary stance and sense of justice. Thus, in practically no time, he managed to rid himself of wife, son, mother, and father. The only thing they bequeathed to him was a fear of women. Tomas desired but feared them, needing to create a compromise between fear and desire. He devised what he called erotic friendship. He would tell his mistresses, the only relationship that can make both partners happy is one in which sentimentality has no place, and neither partner makes any claim on the life and freedom of the other. This entire section in the middle of the second book, or the beginning of the second book, where we start to unwind Tomas, one of the main characters here, Tomas, who's kind of drives the narrative, right? Tomas and Teresa's relationship drives the narrative. And it is a relationship of infidelity. Tomas cheated on his wife and was driven by that. And then Teresa comes alongside of him, and Teresa is, and Kundera never says this out loud, but she's as weak, if not weaker, than Tomas. And Kundera is making a point that by standing next to somebody who's weak, if you are weak yourself, you can mitigate your own weakness and that other person can look, can appear to you to be strong and can, in essence, grow in strength, but will never be any stronger than their strongest weakness. Okay. I agree with Kandera actually on that point. But you read this, and the first thing I thought of was like the story of Peter Pan or Johnny Appleseed, right? And I think one of the critiques of our time, and you said it in a different kind of way, but one of the critiques in our time is that we live in sort of an unserious era, right? And, you know, this book was written in published in 1984. It was probably written, though, in the 60s and 70s. It's kind of a little bit unclear. And yes, you people will email me, and it's fine. Email me about Kandera if you know that it's clear. go ahead and tell me, hey, son, it's clear. You know, when the authorship was of the book, someone will email me with his papers, and it's fine. Go ahead and send me that information. I couldn't find it online. But it's clear from the way that this was written. This was written in the backwash, like we all live right now. We all live in the backwash of the birth control pill. You know, we all live in the backwash of feminism. We all live in the backwash of various civil social movements that occurred in the United States, and revolutions, communist and otherwise, that occurred globally in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Decisions have consequences all the way down to the individual level, and ideas have consequences. The great Paul Johnson, a great British historian, wrote a book called Intellectuals, about the basically the history, the personal history of people who have promulgated ideas from Rousseau all the way to Marx, and from Marx all the way to Sartre, and from Sartre all the way to Derrida, and down to our own time. Because he says, if we are taking the ideas of these people as if they are ways that we should structure a culture, so for instance, the word existential has come down to mean everything that Sartre and Camus did not intend. But it's come down to mean all kinds of different things. And it's not Sartre or Camus' fault, but Johnson makes the point that if we're going to take these ideas from these people, we should go back and look at how they lived and then measure their idea against the reality of their own lives. Okay. Kandera is doing this exact same thing. He's measuring the ideal. He's critiquing, in essence, Christian moralism. He's critiquing the civil strife that has come about, that came about because of, in the West anyway, because of easy divorce and the birth control pill, both of which were, as I said before, or as I just said, you know, were just cataclysmic to the American family, and quite frankly to the global family. And we can argue whether or not that cataclysm was negative or positive, but it did create in men the ability to be Peter Pan. Because when freedom is disconnected from responsibility, as in the case of this clip I just read, this piece I just read, this quote I just read from the book, then you don't have to negotiate with the community anymore. And the community that Tomas is negotiating with was, as it says in here, thus in practically no time he managed to rid himself of wife, son, mother, and father. And so he eliminated the negotiation. He unhooked himself from all of that. And now he's floating with sort of no value system. And the only thing he has to anchor himself to is the state. Now, it's Czechoslovakia in 1968. The Russians invade Czechoslovakia in 1968 in an attempt to... Well, I'm not really clear what the Russians were attempting to do. And Kandera isn't really clear either. He does cover it, but he's not really clear on what the Russians were trying to do there either. But then... because he's anchoring himself to a state that is... I'm going to let the plane go. I don't know why it's flying so low. I can hear it. You all will be able to hear it on the podcast. Yes, I do live near an airfield. Yes, it's strange. They're all over this place. Okay. but he's anchoring himself to this Russian, well, Soviet actual communist ideal, right? Because he doesn't have anywhere else to go. But then he's also engaged in this interpersonal tyranny. And this is in the line of the only thing that bequeathed to him was a fear of women. Tomas desired but feared them. needing to create a compromise. That's a negotiation, by the way, folks. Needing to create a compromise between fear and desire, he devised what he called erotic friendship. And by the way, those of you who are going to read this book, just like with 100 Years of Solitude, no, it is not for kids. There are some things in there that are salacious. I would not give it to my 16-year-old. You know, when you read it, it's definitely written, you know, for an adult to read. You know, there are things that are going on that are adult-oriented in this book. Don't let your kids read it. But this is about real adults making real decisions, right? And untethered from that negotiation, and his job wasn't tethering him either. Like, he was a surgeon. His job wasn't tethering him either. So I guess my question, or maybe my thought here that I'm building up to, is you see families untethered. I had a background in divorce and family mediation for many, many years. You know, saw families untethered from that as well. And then, you know, they go out and they make four or five other families, you know, and then there's just confusion. There's just confusion and chaos everywhere. Wives, sons, mothers, fathers, daughters, and then the community, parents, in-laws. I mean, I was in mediations where in-laws got involved because the in-laws had an opinion in a divorce mediation. And you can argue, well, they shouldn't have an opinion, but they do because they're part of the community. They're trying to give Peter Pan responsibility. And Peter Pan doesn't want responsibility. And it doesn't matter what genitals Peter Pan comes with, Peter Pan doesn't want responsibility. How do we relink those two together? And I do know that I'm going to bring up will to power in a minute here, because I know where Nietzsche would go with this. But I don't think a human being can create their own value system out of their own will. Nietzsche did, but he died too early to like really work through that idea all the way to its logical end. And then the people who came after him didn't have the courage to do it either. Kundera being one of them, but then also Sartre and Derrida and Foucault. They didn't have the courage to take that idea all the way to the end. They just sort of took the idea and went, yes, this is right, and just sort of jumped and ran with it. How do leaders negotiate with the community? How do you bring somebody along who has no anchor?
Fantastic question. I think how do you bring someone along that doesn't have an anchor, or how do you bring someone along that only has their anchor in the ground? I mean,
either one will do. Go with either one. Sure. Because I asked a bunch of complicated stuff there. I layered a bunch of complicated things together. Sure. There.
I think, you know, going, I mean, just a point blank reflection would be this, is that I think you cannot, we have to always know that we cannot force people to do anything. And I think we have to be mindful of the fact that forcing people to do things is what gets us into the hot water to begin with. You know, I think if we go back to this idea of the erotic friendship from Tomas, I think that he makes the fatal mistake of, he said, trying to separate the heart and soul from the body and the mind. And I think that is a luxury of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a luxury that kind of what you're saying too, that we went through this elevation of our culture. We went through this elevation of who we claim to be. And I think as a result of that, I think our hubris got the best of us. And you're talking about how do communicate with the community? I think it has to be on an individual level, or it has to, at least the message has to be of one of an individual talking to an individual. It can be a group setting, but I think that people need, when we can empathize and when we can see each other and we can rationalize the decisions made, and we can walk in someone's steps, or someone can at least paint a picture with their words, that we can understand the context. You mentioned just the importance of understanding these philosophers in the context of their time, in the context of their life. I think that's fundamentally a requirement. And I think anybody who tries to sidestep that or usurp that process is not only fallacious and know what they're talking about, but I think that they're dubious and there's a disingenuousness to it. We don't talk about anything without having a context applied. I don't talk to any client about understanding the context that's been going on. And I say, well, walk me back 2 years. And I think going back to this idea of the community, well, it's not just what's going on in the community today. What transpired a year ago? What transpired 2 years ago? What has been happening in the background? that led to this weird kind of crucible moment we find ourselves in. And I think when we were talking about how, you know, how do you bring someone along? How do you do that? I think fundamentally, maybe a better question needs to be asked. It's not, well, how do we bring them along? It's going, where did we fail earlier? What did we miss way in the beginning of this whole process? You know, an interesting juxtaposition that I like to do that I think fits well with our conversation is just the research work that's come out about attachment theory. Attachment theory has broken the mold on what we understand about people, meaning that what happens to us in our childhood cast shadows for the rest of our life. We can mitigate against those things. We can change those things. But the power of the influence of those childhood experiences, positive and negative, have a huge impetus on what we become, what we pursue. And more importantly, going back to the core of this whole conversation, how do we honor that weird tether between I want freedom, I want autonomy. So do you understand the responsibility involved in what that is, right? And I think that when we, in understanding what happens to our past and understanding that and how it casts shadows, people want quick fixes. People don't want responsibility. People don't want any of that. And I think going the overlay with Thomas and our society is we've made the mistake of creating an ethos of convenience, not an ethos of virtue, not an ethos of righteousness, not an ethos of anything of truth. It's nothing more than simply saying, I want what I want when I want it. Okay, cool. I'm going to reward the behavior that gives me that the most. I'm going to reward the people that give me that the most. I'm going to do that. And like you said, you know, you mentioned the backwash. That's a fantastic way of thinking about this, because it's never one little thing that's the devil, right? It's just that the devil's in the details, right? It's
well, like, there's a lot of snakes in the garden.
Sure. And I think that when we're talking about how do we how do we communicate, how do we do that? I think first and foremost, we have to make sure that we understand that they're willing to listen and their ears are open. And if they're not, well, then I think that's a very different conversation. And I think we have to talk about, well, how do we open their ears? And I think this goes back to what we were talking about before about leadership. Well, how do leaders become leaders? How do leaders gain the respect of the community? And how do they get elevated by the community? I think that's a fundamental, it's a kind of a sidebar tangent conversation. But I think if we're going to try to communicate with people who we might find unreasonable, we might find completely lost or adrift, or maybe propagating things that they don't fully understand, just choosing my words as carefully as I can with them. I think it first goes back to going, do they even want to listen? Do they even want to hear? Or are they cemented in their position? Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. No. A couple things there. For those of us who are listening, what is attachment theory? Because some of us may not know what that is. I'm familiar with a little bit of that, but what is attachment theory?
In a very brief, attachment theory comes out of a study called the ACEs study. I highly recommend people looking into it. It's phenomenal, and it's been a game changer in understanding as an adult, why do I do the behaviors I do, especially if we have problems with relationships, we have problems with our children, we have problems with authority, with touch, with closeness, with intimacy. The ACEs study that came out of, I believe, Seattle back in the beginning of the 90s, it's a longitudinal study that's been tracking things for 20 plus years. It's opened the door to realize that this has a cascading effect about potentials, meaning that if you have, say, in this research, more than four or five ACEs or acute childhood experiences, the risk factor you have for going to jail, being incarcerated, drug abuse, substance abuse, domestic violence, the list goes on and on and on. Your risk factor for these things goes up exponentially to a point where it goes straight vertical. And oftentimes when people, and so this goes back to this interesting thing, this is not deterministic in the sense that if you have these things, you will end out like that. But what it's saying is that we are born into a world with moderating variables, things that we cannot change. We cannot choose our parents. We cannot choose our city. We cannot choose our school. We cannot choose the politics of the day that impact our daily lives. But what we also have is mediating variables. Mediating variables are those powerful conversations, those powerful relationships with not only our parents, but other parental figures as a child, friendships we make. And these things help essentially mediate against the potential consequences that have been laid out for you. Like, well, you have all these, you have a divorce in the family, that's an ace. You have substance abuse in the family, that's another ace. You have a parent that's incarcerated, that's another ace. You have parents that are doing domestic violence and the violence on you, that's an ace. And that list goes on and on and on. But the attachment theory has led to things under identifying things as secure attachment, you know, unsecure attachment, this ambivalent attachment, and this disorganized attachment. Okay. There's a lot more to that, but I would say that if people want to look into it, it can be an incredible insight about who they are. And if you happen to be doing psychotherapy, it's an incredible conversation to have with a therapist.
Interesting. And then, no, that is interesting. I'm going to get back to that. I'm going to kind of let that percolate in my own head there a little bit. There's a couple of things that pop up to me from that. in talking about therapy, okay, there's an idea in the organizational behavior literature, and it's been around for quite some time, that the best leaders are ones that actively listen. Being a divorce and family mediator and coming out of that background, and you coming out of your therapeutic background and your psychotherapy background, you know that listening is an emotionally laborious act. It requires energy from you, but it doesn't look like you're doing, quote-unquote, anything. The humanist and therapist and researcher Carl Rogers postulated the idea that when you're doing therapy, you should listen to others with unconditional positive regard. Okay, but leaders are impatient. And very often leaders will only do what they are paid for or paid to do, right? And if I'm not paid to listen to you with unconditional positive regard, and let's take the positive out, unconditional regard, and let's take the unconditional part out, just regard, if that's not what I'm being paid for by the structure of the hierarchy, and we're going to talk about structures in just a second here when we talk about the Russians and the 1968 invasion that is covered in Unbearable Lightness of Being. If the structure doesn't care about that, why should I bother?
Fantastic question. Why should I bother if the leaders or the superstructure that I'm a part of doesn't honor?
If the hierarchy is ambivalent at best or hostile at worst, to me doing the fundamental tasks of leadership. Now, I can tell you the position we take in our consultancy, which is do it anyway, shut up. that's quite frankly our posture is, and not shut up, but like I'm not dismissing your objections. I've seen your objections, and none of those are relevant. They're interesting to you, but your team doesn't care about your objections. Your team cares about the things that your team cares about. And of course, individuals on your team are just as selfish as you are. We had, we covered The Prince, right? We covered Machiavelli in a previous podcast. Go back and listen to that one, because that one ties into this one too. And our guest on that podcast talked about the dark triad, right? Machiavellianism, corporate psychopathy, and of course, narcissism, right? And got our thoughts straight on several of those areas and clarified our thinking in several of those areas. Her approach and her idea, and I'm not trying to set up an argument between you and her. You're both in the same field. I'm not trying to set that up. What I'm saying is her postulation is that we all got a touch of narcissism. We've all got a touch of Machiavellianism. We've all got a touch of, psychopathy. Well, maybe not that. She wouldn't go that far. She would say a touch of narcissism, because she wanted to be specific in her words as well. We all have a touch of some of these traits. And the environment is structured to support these traits. And thus, we are going to do them. And we shouldn't really, we should be concerned maybe if they're not working. But if they are working, keep going. My thought on that and our thought on that and my consultancy's thought on that is, and it comes from a core of how I think about, honestly, myself and the world and then who I hire to work with us and clients we choose to work with. I think we have a responsibility, going back to freedom. We have the freedom to be who we are. Absolutely, everybody has that freedom. But we have the responsibility to overcome that. And if that's too hard, that's the path of humanity. That's being a human being. That's the hard parts. The hard parts is checking yourself as a leader, being patient when you would rather be impatient, listening to people with unconditional positive regard who may annoy you, understanding, maybe not necessarily understanding all the aspects of attachment theory, but And our previous guest would agree with you on this too. Leadership does require a context, and placing leadership inside of a context, a contextual relationship between myself and the followers, and honestly evaluating that. And then where we come from in our consultancy is being intentional about that, being on purpose. One of our mottos here is no more accidents for leaders. Stop being accidental. Stop accidental conversation, accidental listening, accidental paying attention. Stop it. Because it's not getting you anywhere. I don't care if the structure supports that. Human beings made structures and they can be unmade. Cultures are made and they can be unmade. I don't really cotton too much to what some social scientists will say, who sort of ignore culture because they don't understand where it comes from. Just because you don't understand where it comes from doesn't mean it's not there. Like if I try to go back to like the 12th century and explain air to people, they're not going to understand that either. Doesn't negate the fact that the air is there. So if the structure doesn't value the thing you are doing, and again, this is the pushback we constantly get. If the structure doesn't value the thing that you're doing, why would I as a leader expend energy on doing it? Why would I expend energy on listening to folks if the structure doesn't care? Why would I spend energy trying to understand the context if the structure doesn't care? Why bother?
Just point blank, I would say that leaders require structure to be leaders at all. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a structure, and if you don't have, I guess, what's the alternative? If the structure doesn't agree with what you have, and then you remove the structure, well, then you're not a leader of anything.
Right.
You have no structure to lead through. And I think that that's also maybe a fundamental principle of leadership, is that leadership is it's a function of the structure in which someone can navigate. Like, you need to have some kind of superstructure to it. And so if the superstructure doesn't agree with what you are doing, I think we're left with maybe two ideas. One is you have to move forward within that and taking, wrestle with your own ethics and morality as you kind of step through that process. Step two would be is amplify yourself as a leader to thus create a new superstructure. Amplify yourself in a way to create something that hopefully other people see what you see. Hopefully other people feel what you feel, and thus a unification can happen of other people sharing that same concern. But I think off the, just as a point, I think that there's, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to this question. I don't think that there's, and I don't think anybody listening to this that happens to be a leader of a team or leader of any kind of maybe movement or group should rake themselves against the coal. You know, if what is the structure that they're in doesn't abide by all the ethical or moral ethos that they hold, I don't think that should be the path that they take, but rather just reflections. Make sure that you are taking time to honor and acknowledge the fact that there is some weird cognitive dissonance happening between me moving forward with this and the convenient willful blindness that I apply to the different things that are in front of me. I think that as long as we are doing that, I think that unfortunately or fortunately, I guess how you frame it, sometimes that's all we are left with. Sometimes we have to reconcile with ourselves as being human, that we are not bigger than the machine.
Lord, cure me of my willful blindness. Back to the book. But even with Karenin's help, Tomas failed to make her happy. By the way, the her is Teresa. He became aware of his failure some years later, on approximately the 10th day after his country was occupied by Russian tanks. It was August 1968, and Tomas was receiving daily phone calls from a hospital in Zurich. The director there, a physician who had struck up a friendship with Tomas at an international conference, was worried about him and kept offering him a job. If Tomas rejected the Swiss doctor's offer without a second thought, it was for Teresa's sake. He assumed she would not want to leave. She had spent the whole first week of the occupation in a kind of trance, almost resembling happiness. After roaming the streets with her camera, she would hand the rolls of film to foreign journalists who actually fought over them. Once, when she went too far and took a close-up of an officer pointing his revolver at a group of people, she was arrested and kept overnight at a Russian military headquarters. There they threatened to shoot her, but no sooner did they let her go than she was back in the streets with her camera. It was true, the general euphoria lasted no longer than the first week. the representatives of the country had been hauled away like criminals by the Russian army. No one knew where they were. Everyone feared for the men's lives, and hatred for the Russians drugged people like alcohol. It was a drunken carnival of hate. Czech towns were decorated with thousands of hand-painted posters bearing ironic texts, epigrams, poems, and cartoons of Brezhnev and his soldiers, jeered at by one and all as a circus of illiterates. But no carnival can go on forever. In the meantime, the Russians had forced the Czech representatives to sign a compromise agreement in Moscow. When Dubček returned with them to Prague, he gave a speech over the radio. He was so devastated after his 6-day detention, he could hardly talk. He kept stuttering and gasping for breath, making long pauses between sentences, pauses lasting nearly 30 seconds. The compromise saved the country from the worst, the executions and mass deportations to Siberia that had terrified everyone. But one thing was clear. The country would have to bow to the conqueror. Forever and ever, it will stutter, stammer, gasp for air like Alexander Dubček. The carnival was over. Workaday humiliation had begun. The carnival was over. A drunken carnival of hate. Kundera draws a parallel here between the invasion of the Russians in 1968 in Czechoslovakia. He draws a parallel between that and this idea of muteness, this idea of illiteracy, this idea of not having a voice. Forget listening, just not being able to talk. One of the more relentless kinds of things that you see, and this is in a different section of the book, when we talk about a guy named Franz and music as noise. One of the things that you see in most totalitarian schemes, whether it's a capital T or a small t, it doesn't matter, is the idea of compelled speech. Now, we haven't gone down this road too often on the podcast, just because, again, we're not a political podcast, even though this may have political shades to it. But the book is political in and of itself. Like, you can't really get away from that. It's a great book that is political. Like, you just can't get away from that. And so the conversation is going to be political, at least a little bit. But Kundera draws this idea to muteness and to a lack of being able to speak. And then later on with another character named Franz that we'll talk a little bit about, he draws a comparison to noise and words that very much struck me. I wrote in the margins as kind of a Derridian dilemma from Jacques Derrida, this idea that the text has no meaning and all meaning is noise. From compelled speech to muteness to the text has no meaning, we now wind up in an era of social media. So we move out of the world of fiction into the world of the now. And most social media is a drunken carnival of hate. Let's be honest. And there seems to be no negotiation that can save folks. I just saw something the other day about Instagram's hate speech problem, right? And, you know, Facebook, Jack Dorsey, just this will kind of timestamp this thing a little bit. Jack Dorsey is announced that he's leaving Twitter. Okay, great. We seem to live in a world where there's more and more speech, but less and less meaning. And the humiliation of Twitter, and I tweet, the humiliation of Instagram, and I Instagram, the humiliation of Facebook, and I use Facebook. The humiliation of these drunken carnivals of hate, which is where it can only end up, which is in a space of humiliation, kind of flummoxes people these days. It flummoxes leaders. And it is a soft form of tyranny when you're compelled to say whatever it is that the platform says you must say in order to stay on the platform. That's soft. That's a soft form of tyranny. It just is. There's really just no other way around it. I do fundamentally believe that this is beginning to leak. After 20 years of this, is beginning to leak into people's day-to-day interactions and into the interactions between leaders and teams at a fundamental level. And I believe that fundamental leakage is beginning to cause problems. It is beginning to cause the kinds of problems that I talked about right at the beginning, the acidity of moral weakness. Because it's a very simple thing to go from censoring yourself because you're engaging in the soft tyranny of needing to be on a platform where you get likes and claps. It's an easy thing to go from there to censoring yourself in real life because what the heck, why not? Now, people may say, well, you've always censored yourself in real life. Yeah, okay. Maybe. But the relentless nature of this beast concerns me greatly. And I think the real cause, not the real cause, the real path of leadership forward is not to destroy the platforms. It's not even to reform them. It's to ignore them and move past them to something else. I don't think they can be ignored. And I also don't think they can be destroyed, nor do I think it's our responsibility to do so. And eventually they will become no more valuable than the speeches that Dubček is giving over the radio. Why don't we deprive them of air? Why don't we put them into muteness and silence? My question or my thought or my idea, I guess, here, Dave, that I want to bounce off you because I said a lot there. My idea that I want to bounce off you is this one. Speaking things into existence creates reality, whether we like it or not. It just does. It creates perceptions of reality, or it creates reality itself. How do leaders move past systems that, and we just talked about like how you got to work inside of the system, or maybe the human thing is you can't overcome the system. Maybe. How do you build another one then within your own team? What's the first step? Right? If you're in a space of compelled speech, what's the first step? Or compelled muteness, what's the first step?
Several ways you can approach that. I think going back just to the social media lens just for a second, I think that if leaders want to make moves, if leaders want to actually do something that actually ignites the passion behind the followers of those leaders, I think that leaders have to be brave enough and are willing to see themselves be brave or be courageous enough to welcome the scrutiny. And I think that we have, in a certain sense with social media, I think one of the weird invisible walls, I don't want to call it a ceiling, but an invisible wall that exists on social media is you either speak the truth and you're cast into the fire, or you hold your tongue and you move on as if nothing's going on, right? And there's like this weird membrane that separates these two things. I know for me, I just take a very calculated approach with social media, and that is I try to avoid it whenever possible, at least with terms to professional lens, because I think that I don't think it's additive. I think it's what we have, and I think that we have sequestered ourselves to using it. But I think that there's some strict limitations on this when you're talking about totality and the idea that they can censor what you say and what you do. And there's this weird compelled speech. Compelled according to who? And I think that maybe leaders have to start asking, compelled according to who? And I also think that maybe with this whole notion of you say, well, how do I move forward? What is this first step with trying to, I guess, if I'm in a system of where that I cannot speak? Well, I think we first have to survey the landscape. What can I step into? What can I use? Second step is, you know, am I willing to bear the cross? And we'll have that conversation maybe later with different things. Am I willing to bear the cross that comes with me forging ahead on this path, this new path? I become a martyr for my virtue. I become a martyr for something greater than myself. Say, I'm willing to take on the lashings, the beatings, and potentially the dip in both my visibility, my audience, my trajectory as a professional, because I believe in this, you know, and I think that that's begun. And I think that there are some arenas that are more more suited for some arenas than others. But I do think that as a starting point, I think that the leader has to first make a decision within himself. Am I going to work within the system I find myself in, or am I going to have my exodus?
I think it begins with the word no. But in a different kind of way than most people think of the word no. and maybe this is just a reframing for what you just said, but it's saying no to one thing, one set of structures or one set of assumptions. And I really think it's a lot about assumptions and expectations. Saying no to one set of assumptions and expectations and saying yes to another. Or if we're going to frame it in a positive way, the Heideggerian sense of being in the world, or if you want to, you know, put it in a Christian context, God, say yes to the call. And I think there's so many leaders that don't say yes to the call. And by the way, people haven't been saying yes for years. So let's put it in a historical context. There were plenty of pastors who were more morally upright, ethical, and probably better speakers than Martin Luther King Jr. in the South in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Actually, I'll go back to the 30s. 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, who could have done what he did. They could have said no to the system and written the letter from Birmingham jail and started the Montgomery bus boycott that eventually turned into the civil rights movement that led to Martin Luther King being assassinated. Because when you pick up your cross and walk up the mountain, there is the possibility that you may be assassinated professionally, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, and yes, maybe even potentially physically. How many people said no? That's too hard for me. People who were better than him said no. Like I'm constantly, and you can't play out a counterfactual because we have to live in history as it is. And this is why removing statues is not wisdom. That's not leadership. That's just reactivity and misguided revolution. You have to negotiate with the past as it was. And so you can't live out a counterfactual. You know, if you're trying to live out a counterfactual, then you know better than the Russians who erased like Trotsky from like pictures and then like killed 100 million people after that. Because it's easy to go from erasing a picture or erasing or knocking down a statue to killing a bunch of people. That's a very short line there. And that's what the entire course of the 20th century has showed us. But it begins with saying no. Or again, in the positive frame, I think it begins with saying yes. Yes, I will pick up this thing up. Yes, I will grab hold of this moment. I will recognize what it is. Yes, I will bend all of my talents and skills and efforts to this thing. Even if, and Martin Luther King Jr., you know, made this speech one time, said, you know, be the greatest street sweeper you can possibly be. So that when the angels of heaven come down and they are looking at clean streets, they go, who cleaned these streets? And you can say, it was me. Like, do your work to the highest possible level you can, even if your work is something as lowly as sweeping a street. But people need to hear that from somebody's mouth. Like, I don't think people are going to know it just in their gut. I mean, some people will, but I don't think everybody's going to just know that. And what terrifies me, and I use that word very, very carefully. Because I don't operate in a space of fear. What concerns me greatly is that with the relentless nature of nihilism and existentialism and deconstructionism and postmodernism, I think there's been 120 years of people saying that they want to be inspired, but without that core anchor. Remember, I asked you the question about anchoring, right? Without that core anchoring, even in their individual selves, they're floating. Now, if you look at people's actual behavior, that's a different thing altogether. And there's this gap between what people say and what they actually do, right? So people will say, oh yeah, nothing matters. It's fine. I can do whatever I want. And then they run out and go get married. They go and go create relationships, right? Or, oh yeah, the text has no meaning, except for the text that I like. That text has meaning. And I'm going to imbue that thing with meaning all day long. And if you try to tell me that it has no meaning, then you're just power hungry and socially unjust and blah, 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 blah. Okay. But I thought the text had no meaning. Yeah, but you can't hold me to my own words. Okay, that's fine. Which is where you get into like cancel culture and nonsense like that. Like that just stuff. I guess it's not an unanswerable thought. It's just another thought that's bouncing around in my head as you're speaking, right? Because, you know, that first step, I think, has to be a no or a yes. It has to be a definitive statement. you know, maybe not necessarily a black or white one, but just something definitive, something that stakes the, that places the psychic stake in the metaphysical ground, and then you can move forward from that.
No, I like how you said that, and I think going back to what I was saying about, you know, maybe sometimes, you know, we can't overcome the machine. I think that again, that's just a function of us saying yes or no, whenever, you know, in the lens that happens. And I think, so what does it take for us to say yes or no? I think we have to, like as Jordan Peterson made a point a lot in one of his lectures, he said, authentic being, you know, we have to stop participating in the lie. We have to stop even participating in the deceptions within the lie. Mm-hmm. Right? We have to be mindful of the fact that if I continue to do those things, or if I do them just blindly, then what I'm on a fast track to nihilism. I'm on a fast track to this very dystopian future, because again, opposed to facing the inconvenient truths of our past, composed to facing the, I guess this whole notion that life is suffering, right? Mm-hmm. We want, opposed to dealing with it, opposed to having some kind of evolution within the soul and of the person to say, how do I going to change my relationship with the things, right? You know, this idea that there are only maybe a handful of things that are on your plan, but there's maybe 25 times, 400 times that amount of things that are going against your plan. We need to become friends of the things that go against our plan, so that we forge ourselves of steel and not out of just paper mache. And I think that so much of what people do with, you know, and I think that there's a lot more people than maybe we think. And I think at least talking with, you know, I guess thousands of people over the last couple of years, I think that it's been fascinating to me to see how many people are standing in the doorway of either saying yes or no, whatever, you know, semantics aside, which way we're casting that.
Sure.
So many people are in the doorway, but they still have their heads turned around, and they're not looking forward. They're still looking at what they're potentially going to leave behind. Mm. And I feel like that I find that in so many people. You know, and I think that when we go back to this idea of authentic being, when we say, I'm not going to participate in this, there's something higher than, there's something bigger than me that I'm going to essentially hold myself to. I'm not even going to sugarcoat this lie. When you're talking about like, well, the text doesn't matter except for my text. Well, how convenient, right? How convenient of you to be able to kind of write in and pen in all of these different little side notes, these side tangents and things that fortify your position but devalue mine, right? Mm-hmm. But I think with that context, I think that, you know, I'll give you this. Maybe it's a great way of saying it. I say this comment, this little passage to clients from time to time when it's fitting. And I say that, you know, life is suffering. And most people know that context, at least within a Buddhist lens, that life is suffering. But then I think people forget that there's more to it, and that life is suffering. And through my suffering, I gain knowledge. And when I apply my knowledge, I become wise. And when I teach my wisdom, I become enlightened. And I think people forget that there are these four phases that we go through as people, especially if we're going to become leaders. Mm-hmm. And going back to how leaders communicate with, you know, the community, I think this process is fundamental. I think that any leader of any value has to suffer. I think they have to know what it means to be in the trench. And I think more importantly, they have to take the wisdom that they found and they experienced in that trench and apply it to their own lives to elevate themselves. And when they now elevate themselves to that knowledge, whether it be spiritual, whether it be systemic, whether it be some other kind of knowledge that they've gained or application within, you know, their profession, I think that when they begin to teach that knowledge to other people, they and self tap into this hidden dimension of this leadership modality. Like, now I'm teaching this knowledge. I'm not teaching it so that you avoid suffering. I'm teaching it so you understand that there's a process involved for you, right? That you, this is the path I had. How did I have this revelation? Well, this is the path I had to walk to it.
Yeah.
And then finally, when you now are applying that wisdom, you're teaching that wisdom of how you teach this to other people, I think that that's where enlightenment comes. And I think that we have a handful of leaders in the world stage that have reached this kind of this top of the mountain. And it's fantastic to listen to them speak. It's fantastic. It's almost captivating in a sense. It's almost religious in a sense when you're in their presence. And it's not that they are better than anybody else. It's just that they have taken a very direct, not accidental, as you were saying earlier, it's a very intentional, a very intentional path into the suffering. They put on their chest waders and say, mm-hmm. I have to go chest deep into the shit. Because if I don't go into the shit, I won't know what it is. And right. I won't know how to navigate it. And I think that that's a weird, there's a palpability to it. I think that if you're around anybody who has been on both sides, both the top of the pyramid and on the base, and they understand every single level in between, I think you know it. I think there's a weird sense of knowing that is not, it's just a weird presence. It's almost like your body can know that someone is being truthful with you. They're being sincere. They're being honest. And I think that there are so many quasi-leaders that entertain themselves in this space. And I think because, again, people love to hear their thoughts regurgitated. They don't like the challenge. They don't like the suffering of having someone challenge them. I think we get, you know, maybe as an off branch for future, a different lens of this conversation, we get all of these little weird schools of thought popping up. We get all of these pseudo leaders waving their own little pseudo leader flags. And I think it causes a lot of problems, especially because that what happens on that personal and that intellectual level and that spiritual level for the individual undoubtedly translates to your business, undoubtedly translates to your family, undoubtedly translates to your.
Well, it's, I love what you said there because it's the, there's a certain, no, it's not even that. I'll frame it this way. I think I said this before on the podcast. When we first started our business years ago, you know, I met with somebody and, you know, it was right at the beginning when everything was, talk about being at the bottom of the pyramid, when everything was sucking. And, you know, she gave me some wisdom, which was hard won wisdom. And I realized that I realized it intellectually at the time, which is why I was open to accepting it because it was, she framed it in such a way that I would be open to accepting it. And now even now, many years later, as I think back on it, kind of like in 100 Years of Solitude, Colonel Arcadio Buendia, reflecting all the way back on, you know, when his father showed him the discovery of ice. as I reflect back on it many years later, oh, and by the way, Arcadio Buendia was facing the firing squad, by the way. Anyway, but as I think back on it many, many years later, the thing she told me was, it's going to take you 10 years to be an overnight success. And I've made videos about this. I've written a couple blog posts about it because it's an idea that really strikes at the heart of this sort of get rich quick, we're going to have it happen tomorrow kind of idea. Which, again, just like all ideas, has probably always been in the world. Yes, okay, I'll grant you that. But the speed with which that idea is delivered to you is faster now than it has ever been before. No, I don't think anybody can argue with that. And anything that is worthwhile that you are going to set your path on or set on the path to or try to walk to the clearing at the end of the path is going to take you a long time. It just is. So, case in point, like you and I played rugby. I'll talk a little about rugby for just a minute. I was terrible at rugby. Just terrible. I was terrible. I mean, like, you know, I was always on, you know, the other end of the field. I wasn't where I needed to be, blah, blah, blah. It was horrible. Okay. And I got a little bit better over time. But eventually, you know, I hit a point where I was like, you know, I'm done. I don't want to go down that next piece of the path, right, to do the next thing. My body was beaten. It's physically exhausted, mentally exhausted, emotionally exhausted. I had reached my ceiling, right? That wasn't the fault of rugby. That wasn't the fault even of the teams that I played on or the coaches who coached me or the systems that I was in. That was my fault. I decided I was done. The system didn't spit me out. I said, nope, you know what? I'm done. I'm done playing your game. Same thing in higher education. You know, I was an adjunct instructor for many years. I was on the administrative end of higher education for many years. I think my wife and I did the numbers like dang near 20 years. Now in 20 years in higher education in one form or another on any end of that system, you should have advanced, right? Now we can say, oh, it's the system that held you down or you didn't have the correct mentors. You make up all these ideas, but no, I decided I'm out. I'm finished. I've gotten what I need to get out of this thing. And it took me 20 years to figure out what that thing was that I needed to get, because I'm hard-headed when it comes to certain things, and I just keep going. And that's just it. That's the element of self-awareness there. Rugby, higher education. Now I'm starting down the road on, I just started rolling in jiu-jitsu. So all those of you who are listening to the podcast, you know, mark this moment. Yes, I just started rolling in jiu-jitsu. I've been to like 4 or 5 classes. You know, I've got a background in the martial arts anyway. Okay. And I didn't wrestle. I'm not that guy. But I decided I was going to go do jiu-jitsu. I'm beginning to realize 4 or 5 classes in, oh, this is going to be one of those things. This is going to be one of those 10 years to be an overnight success thing. And it's fine. The more of those experiences you have, the more of your ego gets stripped away. This is why fundamentally leadership, I think, is typically an old person's game. Man or woman doesn't matter. An old person's game rather than a young person's game. So young people can have it. You mentioned earlier in your comments, you mentioned position. Leadership is not position. You're correct. It's not. But many young leaders believe that leadership is position because that's all they got. They don't have the 10 years of overnight success yet. They don't have that path yet. They don't have that enlightenment. They haven't been through the suffering from the base to the top yet. My concern for the moment is, and again, I don't use the word terrify. My concern for the moment is I don't see enough young leaders committing to that path for 10 years. Now, maybe they're doing it a different way. I'll grant you that. Maybe they are. Maybe they're in all the job hopping and great resignation and I don't want to work for a boss for more than 2 minutes. Maybe in all of that, they're going to compile together a bunch of experiences that fundamentally in, 30 years, you know, we will reveal an entirely new leadership culture that will be great, you know, in the world. It will lead us to a glorious nirvana. I got to admit, I doubt that, but maybe I would like to be wrong. I really would. I know it sounds like in my voice right now, like, oh, he's not going to be. No, I would like to be wrong.
To your point, though, about yeah. saying why you don't see enough young people wanting to take on maybe the more visible path, the more visible or the more maybe.
Or maybe they are taking it on, but they're not showing it on all the places where everybody else is showing the easy path.
Sure. I think that there's a definite schism that's happened. I think that there are two actual factions. I think that there is a tremendous amount of depth and quality and potential in one half of the schism, meaning that I think that I get very excited and very optimistic for some of the young leaders that are coming up. At least the ones that I've seen speak or the ones I've listened to their work or read their material, because there is a subsect, I would say maybe 35-40% of this mob of new leaders that are coming out that are actually doing their due diligence. And I praise them heavily for that. And I think that we should never, we have to be careful we don't disregard the youth, because I think that there is an intelligence of youth, there's a freshness of youth. And I think if their parents, if the systems that they grow into cultivate a process within them, I think there's a tremendous potential that comes out of this next generation. That being said, I think the vast majority is not doing that. And I think it's very evident in that, because again, perception is reality. Reality is not reality. And if I am perceived to make money, think about how much this happens with, you know, it seems like there's no end to young men and women on YouTube or on some other platform that have a podcast about being the expert or being a some kind of a dating expert, some kind of thought leader, some kind of wanting to give their take, their review. Okay, that's fine.
The 25-year-old life coach. Those folks drive my wife crazy.
Well, right. And I think, and it should drive you crazy, because again, it's, and I don't blame them, but I just think that there's an ignorance, a certain level of ignorance that I don't hold it against them fundamentally, but I do think I criticize them because they're not doing their due diligence. How can you, why? I think the older people get, I think the less that they want to be in charge, because I think that they know what actually what the depth of that well is. And I think that young people have a certain, an ignorance of experience. And I look at some of the senators in our Congress, and I look at some of the leaders we have, and I'm like, it's not a personal attack against them. It's just saying, you have far too much gusto in your sails and not enough boat, right, to handle mm-hmm. this push. You're going to tip over. You're going to get capsized. And I see it all the time. And it's amazing to me that due to that whole notion of perception being reality, if I have position, well, shit, the perception is there. I am a senator. I am this leader. I have a million followers. I have whatever. It doesn't matter if I'm proclaiming nonsense. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter if I'm the propagator of just complete and utter shit. It doesn't matter. Right. Look, the proof's in the pudding. And I think that when we, because the vast majority of the mob plays in that arena, and it's this very Pokemon mentality of I gotta catch them all, gotta get all the subscribers, gotta get everyone there, I think it drowns out the real depth and the beauty of this other population of young people. And it just goes back to what we were talking about before, about just this authentic being. I think the role of the more maybe enlightened or the maybe more experienced person in their 30s through 60s through 70s that wants to participate in this arena, I think this is where the authentic being really needs to show up. Mm-hmm. I think this should not be something that we leverage against the youth of tomorrow. I think this is something that is a fundamental call to arms for the wisdom of yesterday and the wisdom of today. It's we know better. We've already seen it, right? You, even if you're only in your mid-30s, you've already lived through enough experiences to go, ooh, why would I want to do more of that?
Right.
And I think if you get to talk to people in their 40s, they're like, absolutely no more of that. Right. Talk to people in their 50s and 60s. They're like, not careful. Right. You're going to be reliving my life story. And why did I work so hard to get us to a place where you didn't have to do that just for you to spit in the face of wisdom, just for you to spit in the face of this lesson. And so you can go back and relearn it. And maybe. But I also think that there is also I don't know if it's appropriate for this podcast, but I think that there's a certain level of esotericism and a certain level of hiddenness and a certain level of dubiousness that is also in this space. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. that I'm going to let you be the governor of how you want to handle that that level of conversation, but I think that
might be something we may have to hold for Augustine and City of God. We may have to hold on to that, because that may be the spot, or maybe Confessions from Augustine when we read that, or maybe my favorite Julius Caesar. I might hold it for Shakespeare, but keep going. Yeah, dubiousness and esoteric. Yeah, there's a little bit of that.
You know, I just think it goes back to values.
Right.
You know, I think that this whole what I really am referencing by this esoteric and this dubious kind of nature of things, this lens, is that they've convinced people that money usurps God, and they've convinced people that money is God, and they've fundamentally shifted it away from what it originally was, which is money is something more than a tool. Mm-hmm. And if you understand how to leverage that tool, you can make a myriad of different things happen. And I think, again, this is where that schism is divided. I think that there are people who, not just with youth, but I think our society together has divided into two camps. I don't think it's political. There's correlations with political, but I don't think it's fundamentally political. Right. I think that there are some people that are saying, I would rather have the inconvenient truth to know what the truth is and to move forward from a position of just authenticity. I need to know where we stand. If we need to have some level of just, you know, sincerity with one another and authenticness with each other, so we can move forward stronger, regardless of what the truth is. And I think that there's other people that says, well, this sounds like a lot of work. This sounds like it makes it so it's not so much fun. And I don't know if I want to subscribe to that. Why don't we just go back to sex, money, and drugs? I like sex, money, and drugs. Let's go to sex, money, and drugs, and let's just push that agenda as far as we can. And I do think that that lens, as simplistic as that might seem, is what we have. Because again, who gets the most hits on, essentially, on YouTube? It's nothing of note. It's not life-changing information. It's about money. It's about entertainment. It's about convenience. Fine. But again,
No, yeah, no. There's so truth telling, right? And this idea of memory, right? Truth telling and forgetting and the generations. I love what you said there, the generations having to relearn, or not, I mean the generations, individuals in their own life cycle having to relearn the same old lessons. So there's a writer named Ewan Morrison wrote an article called Milan Kundera warned us about historical amnesia. Now it's happening again. In March of 2019, you can go find it online. I want to quote extensively from this because it actually supports what David's saying here. Quote, after the fall of the USSR, there was a vast outpouring of truth-telling about the fallen communist regimes in Russia, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Bulgaria, Hungary, Albania, Romania, and Poland. All that were behind the Iron Curtain, by the way. The stagnant debt and corruption, the human rights abuses in political prisons and orphanages, the hidden mass graves, the illegal human experiments, the secret surveillance systems, the assassinations, the mass starvations, and the overwhelming evidence of the failure in each country of the quote-unquote planned economy. The structures, too, of government misinformation, the eradication of free speech, and the rewriting of history, things we've talked about just now on this podcast. Erasing your opponents by murdering them and then wiping all traces of their existence from the history books. Cancel culture, folks. In the 90s, the hidden data from Stalin's famine genocide in the Ukraine, 1923 to 1933, called the Holodomor, by the way, if you want to go Google that, was exposed. Later, the scale of Chairman Mao's genocide staggered the world. Even the methods that communist regimes used to produce historical amnesia were exposed. By the way, that's his first paragraph. Next, for a brief period, the consensus was that the communist experiment had failed. For a brief period, the consensus was that the communist experiment had failed. Never again, said the postmodernists and the historians. Never again, said the economists and the political parties. Never again, said the people of former communist countries. Never again. Fast forward 20 plus years, and never again has been forgotten. The Wall Street Journal in 2016 asked, "Is quote is communism cool? Ask a millennial." Last year, MIT Press published Communism for Kids, and Teen Vogue ran an excited apologia for communism. Tablet, which is an online magazine, announced with some concern a quote, cool kid communist comeback, unquote. On Twitter, there is a new trend of people giving themselves communist themed names: Gotha communist, trans communist, commie bitch, eco communist. The hammer and sickle flag has been reappearing on campuses, at protests, and on social media. By the way, this was written in 2019. If you go look at some of the protests from 2020, particularly the protests around Black Lives Matters, lot of hammer and sickle flags at those protests. Just gonna point that out. How could we have forgotten? A poll in the UK by the New Culture Forum for 2015 showed that 70% of British people under the age of 24 had never heard of Chinese communist leader Mao Zedong. While out of the 30% who had heard of him, 10% did not associate with him with crimes against humanity. Chairman Mao's communist regime was responsible for the deaths of between 30 to 70 million Chinese, making him the biggest genocidal killer of the 20th century, above Stalin and Hitler. One of the reasons Mao's genocides are not widely known about is because they are complex and cover two periods over a total of 7 years. Information on the internet tends to be reduced into fast-read, simplified narratives. If any facts are under dispute, we have a tendency to shrug and dismiss the entire issue. So it is precisely the ambiguity over whether Mao's Communist Party was responsible for 30, 50, or 70 million deaths that leads to internet users giving up on the subject. This is why we're going to cover the Gulag Archipelago. As a side note, this is why we're going to cover Solzhenitsyn's great book. This is why. The rational way of dealing with clashing estimates would be to look at the two polls, to say at the bare minimum, even according to pro-communist sources, Mao was responsible for 30 million deaths. And at the other extreme, from the most anti-communist sources, the number is 70 million. So it would be reasonable to conclude that the truth lies somewhere in between, and that even if we were to take the lowest number, it is still greater than the deaths caused by Stalin and Hitler. However, this reasoning does not occur. This is the money quote, as the marketing boys say, from Ewan Morrison, writing for Quillette in March 2019. This is the money quote. Our reaction when faced with a disputed piece of data like this is similar to our response when faced with a Wikipedia page that carries the warning, quote, the neutrality of this article is disputed, unquote. Fatigue and lack of trust kicks in. And so, without an argument needing to be made by Mao's apologists, the number he killed is not zero, but of zero importance. As a side note, Rage Against the Machine back in the day said, you don't have to burn the books, just remove them. Conflict-induced apathy can be manipulated for political ends. That's the second money quote. We see this in the way that neo-communists set out their stall. They don't challenge the data about the number of 20th century deaths their ideology is linked to. Rather, they claim that there are conflicting data, and anyone claiming one data set is definitive has a vested interest in saying that, ergo, no data are reliable. And so they managed to airbrush 30 to 70 million deaths from history. Kundera warned us about all of this. Somebody a little more ancient than that warned us of this too. fellow about 2021 years ago warned us of all this. You know, he said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you continue in my word, you are my true disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. We are Abraham's descendants, they answered. We have never been slaves to anyone. How can you say we will be set free? Jesus replied, truly, truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. A slave is not a permanent member of the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Look, the truth of anything will make you depressed. And sin means missing the mark. If you're forgetting, if you're part of that crowd that Deo was just talking about, and you're on purpose forgetting because you're too confused by the data, or you have conflict-induced apathy, or you just can't hold two poles in your head, and by the way, you've been given a position of leadership, you need to go back and do some work. You need to go back and do the work of remembering, because you're sinning. You're missing the mark. You're missing the core thing. Kundera warned us about historical amnesia, and when you have historical amnesia, you are doomed to maybe not necessarily repeat the past exactly in the same fashion, but you're doomed to echo it. And an echo is always worse. Back to the book. So Teresa was therefore, and Teresa is Tomas's mistress. Teresa was therefore born of a situation which brutally reveals the irreconcilable duality of body and soul, that fundamental human experience. A long time ago, man would listen in amazement to the sound of regular beats in his chest, never suspecting what they were. He was unable to identify himself with so alien and unfamiliar an object as the body. The body was a cage, and inside that cage was something which looked, listened, feared, thought, and marveled. That something that remained or left over after the body had been accounted for was the soul. Today, of course, the body is no longer unfamiliar. We know that the beating in our chest is the heart, and that the nose is the nozzle of a hose sticking out of the body to take oxygen to the lungs. The face is nothing but an instrument panel registering all the body mechanisms, digestion, sight, hearing, respiration, thought. Ever since man has learned to give each part of the body a name, the body has given him less trouble. He has also learned that the soul is nothing more than the gray matter of the brain in action. The old duality of body and soul has become shrouded in scientific terminology, and we can laugh at it as merely an obsolete prejudice.
I think maybe with that, my comment I've made on the record with other people is I think that one of the greatest transgressions against humanity is making a very complicated subject simple. And I think when we talk about our existence and we talk about what it means to be us, we talk about, I guess, modern science. I think that I don't know any squelches with modern science. Science is a process, and that's all. I think that we have to remind ourselves of that it's a process, it's not the truth. It's the process to pursue the truth. And sometimes that process gets distorted with certain things. I think that we also, as people, like our information nice and tidy. We like our realities nice and tidy. We like everything very, very digestible. We like the individually wrapped fruit snack kind of way of having life. We want our own individual versions of this.
The charcuterie board of truth. Lunchables for adults, as my wife would call it.
You know, I mean, that's really what it is. And I think that I just think that, you know, as much as the past is our future and the future is our past, I think we're relearning the wisdom of yesterday. And I think that as much as science has moved us forward, I do think that there's limitations if we don't circle back. I think that we have to entertain that there's a cyclical nature to everything in life, but yet we obfuscate that reality when it comes to science. I find that fascinating. And I find it fascinating too that when within under the guise of science, which I don't think scientists believe this at all, but I think under the guise of science, I think people have made the argument to discredit God and to discredit spirituality and to discredit the soul from the mind, which I think is a grave injustice to just who we are as a species, because I think that there's something unique and undeniable. I think it's as simple as taking a walk alone in the woods. Do that and tell me that you don't have something that's more intrinsically binding you to this space, right? I'm not going to get in the weeds, whether it's God with a capital G or lower G, or if you even believe in that. But what I would say is that there's a spiritual nature to us. And I think that if we think about the word magic, I think magic is just science we haven't discovered yet. And I think that there is a certain magic to us as a species. I think that there's a certain magic to us as each country has its own version of that. Each culture has its own version of that, a uniqueness to ourselves.
And you see this with 100 Years of Solitude, right? I mean, Garcia Marquez is writing about, the Macondo, as a city born in myth, born out of magic in essence. And he writes in the genre of magical realism, you know, which is a very specific genre to Latin America, where, as one person put it to me, you know, things are going along, and then like, bam, like rain falls upside down from the sky and it makes no sense. But he's set up in 100 Years of Solitude, that way to, and you framed it before as a membrane, and that way to permeate that membrane. And when rationality and scientism, which is what I call it, when rationality and scientism and all of the atheist stuff fails, because there's only two atheists I've known who ever died with the courage of their convictions, David Hume and Christopher Hitchens. Everybody else, who knows what they said at the end? It's not recorded. But when everything goes to the end and fails, something's got to push you through that membrane. And there is that membrane. And we talk about it in terms of leaders becoming self-aware, taking, you know, reflection and journaling and engaging in those types of practices on a daily basis to reconnect with that thing that's through the membrane. It's interesting that you talked about it in terms of magic, because that's exactly how myth is framed. Jung would say that. We can go jog down that road in another podcast, but Jung would say that, for sure. So would a couple of other folks, but Carl Jung would be probably the biggest, you know, head on that mountain. Leaders have a responsibility to penetrate that and have a responsibility to get through that. And you're right. Like I think you're correct in your assertion. We anthropomorphize our objects. So we have phones and we have computers. We're going to have AI and robotics at scale, you know, and we're going to anthropomorphize these technologies. We're going to give them human traits. I think of the movie AI that was made 20 years ago, which is basically just the Pinocchio myth redone with a boy robot and a sad ending, which is what you get when Steven Spielberg tries to do a movie that he probably really shouldn't have done, and should have left alone. But anyway, because Steven Spielberg likes happy endings. He's from the happy ending director kind of mode. But you're going to get that. You're going to get Jude Law and a bunch of dead robots in a junkyard somewhere. And we'll anthropomorphize those objects, but they won't be human. They just won't. Now, I'm not going to get into consciousness and all of that, because that's another area that links into this idea of magic and myth and then can reconnecting and all that. I'm not going to get into that. But leaders have to know what's real and what's not. And we talked about this in 100 Years of Solitude. Leaders have to know about the difference between what's real and what's not. And leadership genuinely requires that. Yeah, go ahead.
I would agree. I think that, you know, and I think I'm just on that same vine of consciousness. I think it's past conversation. And I think that there's an argument to be made that consciousness can exist without a soul. And but again, different conversation. If you go back to what you're saying too about, you know, leaders need to know what's true or what's real and what's not. Fundamentally, if you don't, then you're not leading anything. You're simply just treading water. And it's like, and I think that this is where we could go back to that kind of the critique of our society at the here and now, and we talk about what's actually transpiring and what are some of these agendas that are at place with totality and different things. The thing that we haven't really talked about yet about the book is referencing how totality destroys the opportunity to pursue my true self. And when we have to make sure that we understand that is true, not only in this book, but that's true as a leader. That is true as your team. That is true in the communities you find yourself in. Anyone who is regulating our speech in a free society, obviously with the limitations that I think are reasonable, we'd all agree about reasonable, with hate speech and all other things. Not this misconstrued version that language can be violence. I'm not a big fan of that notion because, again, who's judging that? Who's rating that? Who is the arbiter of that line? I don't want to get in that conversation. And I don't think anybody should get in that conversation because I think that it's fundamentally kind of just a pitfall. No matter how you talk about it, you get to the same place. But what I do think is that we have to be careful and we have to be willing to find our voices as a community and as people, not just on an individual level, but in a community level, but especially if you're in a position of note. If you're in a position of note, any society and in any superstructure, it becomes almost like an ethical obligation that you do not participate in the lie. Mm-hmm. You do not participate in the nonsense. You mentioned in the very beginning of our conversation, we talked about how things were before, you know, social media. And I think just as interestingly is, let's go back to just the dawning of social media. Why was certain things okay then, but not that they're not okay now? And I think that simple juxtaposition of, well, our society wasn't burning then. So wait, how do we designate what is or is not necessary? What is or is not needs to be censored? Again, I'm not the expert.
Well, who adjudicates that? You just said you don't want to get into being the arbitrator of that. Well, that's socially constructed. That is a social negotiation. And that is socially constructed, which the social constructivists understand that part of the game. And that's why they're playing that way. The rest of us who are just sort of walking around and don't have time to worry about, or maybe don't have time to worry about, we started off with family, who learned in family how negotiation works and doesn't, but don't really understand our own motives or know how to ask for what we want, are going to struggle inside of a social constructivist model where we're going to arbitrate language. We're going to arbitrate speech. Yeah. Because they don't know the rules. They don't know what the rules of the game are. They're not even playing the same game on the same board.
Well, they don't even play well with each other. And
right.
The social constructivist lens, at least, and this is just maybe more my opinion, I do think that there are some academic points that they make. There are definitely some intellectual points that are to be made there. That being said, I think like many good academic points, they don't really find their way. They don't find a good foothold in the real world. Mm-hmm. I can think of maybe more than two dozen ideas that are academically profound and academically present. And people can argue until they're blue in the face and their points are justified academically. But I think when we apply these things, where the rubber meets the road in reality, I think that we have yet to be brave enough to say that this is a fantastic idea. This is a very utopian idea that if we could pull this off, wow, that's something spectacular. And I think if you look at like even the writings of Marx in a vacuum, it's a beautiful idea. Marx in reality doesn't work. he fundamentally denied the one of the most key components of his whole, the biggest flaw in Marx's notion, at least in my opinion, is he denied humans being dynamic. He denied people wanting to move up, wanting to pick themselves up, wanting to essentially ascend. Mm-hmm. And I think that the lack of even considering that makes his whole proposition, makes the idea of communism, in my opinion, nothing more than a fleeting idea, nothing more than like a fart in the wind, as you'd say. It's like, it was good for a moment, but that's about it. You know what I'm saying? It's as good as, you know, it's like the idea of segues, right? Good for a moment, but we're not going to use segues going everywhere. That's what I compare it to. It's like, wow, great, fantastic. We're going to really change the world with this. No, you're not. Because again, practical application, there's no point to it. There's no one's going to buy in.
Staying on the path. This is typically how we end our podcast. We talk about how to stay on the path. I think what David has just said there is how you stay on the path. You fundamentally get into practicality. Unbearable lightness of being is a deeply philosophical and deeply difficult book. And it's difficult not because of the content. It's difficult because of the doors to ideas that it opens that then the reader has to wrestle with. The biggest idea is communism. That's why we've been talking about it for the last hour or so. Communism, not just in a political context, but communism all the way down to a dyadic context between two people. And the kind of tyranny that creates what we opened our podcast episode today with, that creates moral weakness, which then in turn leads to collapse. It leads to disillusionment. It leads to destruction of relationships. It leads to human nakedness utilized as humiliation. So I'm going to close with this line from Kundera. Once again, the unbearable lightness of being. Marching naked in formation with a group of naked women was for Teresa the quintessential image of horror. By the way, she has a recurring nightmare, a dream, in this book. When she lived at home, her mother forbade her to lock the bathroom door. What she meant by her injunction was, "Your body is just like all other bodies. You have no right to shame. You have no reason to hide something that exists in millions of identical copies." In her mother's world, all bodies were the same and marched behind one another in formation. Since childhood, Teresa had seen nudity as a sign of concentration camp uniformity, a sign of humiliation. If you go back and look at pictures from the concentration camps, from Pol Pot, going all the way back to Adolf Hitler, or if you want to update it, Rwanda in the 1990s. Anytime there has been mass killing or mass graves, the bodies are stripped naked. We may not believe fundamentally anymore in the big G conception of God. It may not be at the center of our public discourse or the center of our public square. And God may be dead, according to Nietzsche. And we may be able to self-create our own values, although Nietzsche struggled with that idea. We may be existentially weak, and we may live in a place where there's nothing but grabs of power between disparate, socially constructed groups that shift and change all the time. Okay, I'll give you the modern world, and I'll double down and stake you. And then I will say this, I will assert, God still lurks around the edges. He or she, and let's not gender an entity, still floats around. And the trouble with Nietzsche and other original thinkers like Freud and Picasso and others is not the original thinker or doer or even the leader of the original thinkers, but their acolytes, their followers, their disciples. And it turns out that for the last 120 years or so, human intellectuals in the West haven't come up with a solution to the Nietzschean dilemma that then morphed into an existential, deconstructed, and postmodern dilemma of how an individual can create a solid, impeccable, replicable value system across time. We haven't figured this out. Tyranny, coercion, compelled speech, whether on an on-campus, in a syllabus, or on Twitter, is an irrelevancy. And bureaucratic handholding can never create the values that human beings need to live and flourish in a complicated, messy, and morally ambiguous environment. People of belief are often mocked and dismissed, but that mocking doesn't eliminate the power of their first principles. Remember, I said God still lurks at the edges. Leaders need to remember that knowing at your core what your value system is, from where it comes, and the challenges to it makes you a better leader, not a weaker one. There's nothing more demoralizing and less worth of negotiating than conflict-induced apathy. Love that line. And leaders would do well at this time to attach themselves to belief systems that repudiate the last 120 years and reach towards something deeper and more eternal. And by the way, when we talk about on this podcast the theology of leadership, this is really genuinely what we're talking about. And we've gotten into the theology and philosophy of leadership today. If leaders don't do this, and if they fail at this challenge, if they fail to say yes or say no, the best that leaders can do is cast long shadows as the sun continues to set in the West. Well, that's it for me. I think that's it for here today. David, do you have anything for us today? And by the way, thank you for coming on. Thank you for providing a foil to me today, or support, or challenging me and pushing me and just bringing up some ideas. I had a great conversation. Do you have anything for us today for staying on the path, for getting where we need to go?
I think maybe as a parting thing following this conversation, I think that people need to remind themselves that it's our duty, and I'm going to underline that 5 times, duty to step into the fire of life. Because it's not, we're not stepping into the fire because we're playing with something we want to get burned by. We're stepping into the fire because we have to know how much heat we can handle. It's fundamentally a requirement. And I think that we have to get to a place as individuals, if we want to see ourselves ascend, we want to see ourselves kind of transcend our past and become a bigger and better and more powerful version of ourselves. I think we have to start inviting ourselves, or maybe reminding ourselves, to be brave. We have to step up. We have to be the ones to take action, and we have to stop going to authority figures to clean up our mess. Right. I think that's all I would. I mean, that I think that's a fundamental way of just encapsulating this, because it's when we pass the buck forward that if everyone's doing that, then somebody, usually our family members, usually the people on our team, usually our friends, are the ones that get caught in the crosshairs of that, because we failed we failed to act. We failed to take that stand. We failed to, find the courage to step into the fire. I think maybe the last thing I would say is that in terms of how we strengthen ourselves as people and as individuals, both psychically, spiritually, and just physically, it's exposure. We have to become exposed to things. Any clinician worth their weight in salt will tell you that there's only one thing that cures essentially fear, anxiety, worry, apprehension. It's exposure. The research on this is clear. It's not up for debate. You need to become exposed to adverse ideas, adverse people, adverse words, adverse circumstances. Otherwise, you will be crushed under the weight of the first challenge that you come across. And if we don't do this, this idea of safe spaces, I spoke out about this when it came up. This is not a good idea. This is bred out of pseudo-intellectualism. This is bred out of this whole idea that if I just cancel these people or block these people from my world, then hey, my problem is solved. Unfortunately, that's not the case. That's putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole wound. And eventually we're going to run out of blood. We're eventually going to bleed out from this. And I think, at least maybe as a parting piece too, just on the terms of psychotherapy, is for anyone that's listening and anyone who wants to get involved in that, do your homework, shop around. It's important that you find someone that challenges you, not someone that aligns with you as a psychotherapist. And I think that the more people demystify going to see a therapist, but more importantly, again, take on the responsibility, take on the accountability, do some research, find people that are going to both be there for you as a therapist, but at the same time, are not just going to nod their head and agree with everything you say. You don't get anything out of that. That's not therapy. That's just a conversation. And I think that, I guess that's maybe a great way to kind of, I guess, my piece on this, my lens on this, is this book is an interesting reflection on society and an interesting reflection on how all things roll downhill. And we have to be very, very accountable, not only to our own world, but to the leaders we elect and to holding them accountable. And I think also, too, we have to be very accountable to ourselves. I do not deserve love if I'm not prepared to give love. I do not deserve to lead if I'm not willing to follow someone else before I lead. I think that these are these fundamental concepts, these fundamental qualities that somehow, some way, we have just been maybe distracted away from, is maybe the best way of saying it. And I think the faster and the sooner we can get back in line with connecting with these core ideas, these core principles that strengthen us, engage in behaviors that make us stronger, stop telling ourselves things that make us weak, stop engaging in behaviors to deny yourself the opportunity to see yourself be brave. I think that that is the path forward, not just for leaders, but for people all around us, because in a weird sense, we all are leaders. We just have failed to recognize it yet. And I think that the more we understand that there is, there's a very obvious lens on those people in positions of power, positions of note as leaders, it's fantastic. That's fine. But I think we have to be careful. We don't forget that we are also leaders within our household. We are leaders within our friend group. We are leaders within the covenant of our church. If we go to church, we're leaders in the covenant of our community. And a denial of that responsibility on an individual level does just as much damage as totality from the top down.
Words to live by. If you'd like to get practical in staying on the path and walking into the fire and learning how to sew up the bullet hole so you can stop bleeding out, we've got some products and services for you. So head on over to the HSCT Publishing site, hsctpublishing.com, for a list of all of our training and webinar products, products that are designed and services and experiences that are designed for you remotely or in person to stay on the path, to figure out what the path is, and to figure out how to walk through the fire. Our leading key solution, which is initially designed for long-term care and will be open up to a much broader audience in January of 2022, is available at leadingkeys.com, featuring forums, featuring asynchronous content, featuring a platform where you can ask us questions and live chat, where you can talk to us about your leadership problems and get practical, not theological, but practical leadership solutions to your problems. Our remote training services can also be offered live. In January 2022, we will be expanding to live events. Okay. We'll be hosting 4 live events across the country. More information to come. Stay here and figure that out and learn more about that in this space. You can also check out our Leadership Toolbox solution at leadershiptoolbox.us. One whole program designed to make your managers and supervisors better leaders. I've also written a couple of books. But probably the most interesting book is My Boss Doesn't Care, 100 Essays on Disrupting Your Workplace by Disrupting Your Boss. Check that out on Amazon.com or anywhere else where you pick up books. A book designed to help you overcome the hierarchy, particularly if you're in the middle of it and you actually want to change it. And my upcoming book, 12 Rules for Leaders, A Foundation for Intentional Leadership. We're wrapping up the end of the first draft on that book, and we're beginning to work on the second draft. We're going to pulling together illustrations for the book. We're releasing that in hardcover. We'll be releasing that in paperback, and we will be releasing that as a digital download via Kindle in April 2022. Please join our pre-order list now by sending me an email, ceo@hsconsultingandtraining.com, and I can put you on the pre-order list for 12 Rules for Leaders, a Foundation for Intentional Leadership. Once you get on the pre-order list, then we will be doing private podcasts, events, and other interesting things that will help you, again, stay on the path. If you'd like to book me for a speaking engagement or to have me come to your company, we do all those kinds of things. We'll be doing more of them next year. You can go to HeySansRills.com for speaking and booking. You can also check out, obviously, this podcast, Leadership Lessons from the Great Books, everywhere where you get podcasts. But you can also check out HeySansRills audio experience. And you can check out the video version of this podcast and a number of our other video products on all of our YouTube channels, HS Consulting and Training, HeySansRills Experience, and a number of other YouTube channels that we have floating around out there, but those are the two big ones. So stay on the path, walk into and walk through the fire, and be the kind of leader that you need to be. I'm out.